You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 92. I'm your host, Chris Webster, with my co-host, Paul Zimmerman. Today, we talk about disappearing archaeological data again, this time with the author of the paper that we discussed last time. Let's get to it. All right, welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast. Paul, how's it going today?
Pretty good. How are you doing today, Chris?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Our guest is somebody who we mentioned was going to be on the show last time in episode 91, if you heard that one a couple of weeks ago or whatever time frame you're listening to these on. And he'd written an article. If you want to go back, we'll have it linked in this show as well. But it was all about archaeology's disappearing data. And I'm not going to go into too much of that again right now, because seriously, go back and listen to episode 91 and you can hear Paul and I talk about our thoughts on this article as we're going to discuss it today. But today we have the author of the article on, and it is Dr. Keith Kinte, and he is going to talk about this article. So Dr. Keith Kinte, welcome to the show.
I'm pleased to be here. Thank you.
Before we get into the article, I want to talk about your background just a little bit. What's your background in archaeology? You are a past president of the Society for American Archaeology, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I'm a professor at Arizona State University, and I've been there. This is my 32nd year. Before that, I was at UC Santa Barbara, and before that, at the University of Arizona. I do my field work in the Southwest U.S., although I've done a bit of work overseas, mainly around the modern Sunni Indian Reservation. And I've been involved and really led the effort from the beginning to create the digital archaeological record.
Okay, great. And we talked to people at TDAR before on this podcast a couple of years ago, I think.
And then I'm also involved in the Coalition for Archaeological Synthesis that I know you had a podcast on not too long ago.
Yes, on the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Yeah. Right. Well, the article that you wrote is called America's Archaeology Data Keeps Disappearing, Even Though the Law Says the Government is Supposed to Preserve It. So let's talk about this a little bit. Can you first summarize the article for us in your words?
Well, basically, the article is intended to say, look, we're spending vast amounts of money collecting wonderful archaeological data that has tremendous ability not only to tell us about the past, but to help inform, I think, present day issues. However, those data are almost completely inaccessible to other researchers, never mind the public. And today, 10 years ago, we didn't have the tools to really make that data widely available and easily accessible. But today we do. And I think we need to move to a situation where the data, especially the data that are created with public money, need to be made accessible and preserved for the long term, as I think the law requires.
Yeah. And when you say data, I want to have you clarify that for us, because some people, of course, that are listening to this podcast are thinking the route of thinking always goes towards looting and damage. And they say, okay, so when you say data, do you mean all the data? Do you mean, you know, certain sites we can see all the data, but on other sites we can only see, you know, maybe artifact or feature data or the description data, but not locational data, things like that. What are you generally referring to when you say data?
Well, when I say data, I mean all the data. I mean that the digital data in this case, the documents, the digital representations of documents, data, archaeological databases or spreadsheets, images, digital images that we've got. Now, how you preserve them, I mean, I think all of that needs to be preserved. What we make accessible is a slightly different question. There's different ways of doing that. But in TDAR, the Digital Archaeological Record, what we do and what we recommend is if there are, we have two kinds of files, ones that are confidential and ones that are open. The open ones, anybody can go on the web, you get access, actually Google indexes them, you can get them however you want. Where reports or databases have locational information, what we suggest doing is uploading two versions. One is a redacted version in which that locational data is removed, and then a full version that's only available with explicit permission of the person or agency that uploaded it. So we are very attuned to the problems of disclosing confidential site locations. And that's actually a legal requirement that we not do that. But by allowing the person who uploaded or is responsible for the report or the database to give permission, other people who have the right credentials and a reason to get the data, can get the full versions.
Okay. And what does TDAR consider to be the right credentials?
Well, what we've done so far is to say we don't decide that. What TDAR has is the ability for the person who did the upload to manage who can have access. I mean, if they want to give somebody, you know, one of their colleagues that's working on the same project, write access to their data, they can do that. They could also give temporary access and say, you know, some graduate student writes them and says, you know, I'd like to get access to this particular data set. That person can go into TDAR and say, give this email address, you know, a 30-day or a 10-day, I forget what it is, read access to this particular file if they determine that that's appropriate. I mean, one of the things we've considered is whether agencies would be interested in an option to work with the Register of Professional Archaeologists to say, if you're an RPA, you could get, you know, access to certain resources that people would give blanket access to RPAs. We haven't implemented that yet, but right now it's really up to the person doing the uploading to decide who gets access. We don't make that decision.
Now, what if, I mean, this isn't a podcast about TDAR, but it's actually really important to have on this podcast. What if somebody uploads a bunch of data to TDAR from a project and then dies in a car accident the next day? How does that get handled if they no longer have access to their account and giving access rights?
Yeah, that's another problem that we've worried about. I mean, what we are trying to do is get, well, in some cases, to have a kind of meta owner of the data. So if it's, you know, the data manager at arizonablm.gov or something, you know, where, mm-hmm. where you could do that. We haven't implemented, we have something, I think for essentially, well, the data set creator can put in an organization that they're affiliated with. We haven't totally dealt with the succession problem, although we are trying to work with people on that. Mm-hmm. And but that is a real issue.
Well, let's back this up again to the article that starts this discussion and that we discussed, as we said, all last episode. And we're happy to have you on here to discuss with us directly. What inspired this? What was the it feels like it was in response to something pressing or something that happened recently. And it's interesting that it was picked up by PBS. Could you explain to us what was the impetus for writing this article, and how did you get it, somebody at PBS to take interest in it?
Well, what happened, I mean, I've been thinking this for a long time. What stimulated the article was the Arizona State University PR office, I forget what they call, media relations office, like that of many other universities, it has a relationship with this online journal called The Conversation. And so The Conversation people, I think, had, and I don't know their own history, but I think they had read about digital data being lost. They contacted the ASU people saying, do you have anybody who could comment on this? And I, because of some expertise that they thought that I had, they contacted me, the ASU people contacted me and said, do you have anything from archaeology that might be interesting for this? And so I wrote a little short couple of paragraphs saying, this is what I would say if I were doing this. And The Conversation came back and said, yes, we're interested in having you write that. Would you do it? And so I worked with their staff to write it. And then they do everything open access with Creative Commons licenses. And so anybody can pick it up. And PBS, I didn't have anything to do with PBS picking it up. They chose to do that themselves.
Okay. And who is the audience, the intended audience for this article? Who did you hope would read this and gain something from it?
I mean, the intended audience is a broad one. They give you statistics back. And according to The Conversation dashboard, I have 19,000 people have clicked on the article and mm-hmm. presumably read at least part of it. What I'm hoping to do in part is to generate, some policymakers read it, and to generate perhaps some public sentiment that, oh yeah, we should be doing that. That could speak to either directly or indirectly to the agency people who are in a position to do something about this. So, I mean, the indirect audience was intended to be the policymakers. The sort of direct audience was really the general public as well as professionals.
How do you personally address the situation of, I mean, right in the title of the article, you say, you know, the government is supposed to preserve this according to the law, supposed to preserve data. But I mean, I work in Nevada, you work in the desert Southwest, you know, we both work with the BLM a lot. And we know who's working at the BLM. I mean, I know who's working at the BLM district offices where that I deal with. They're usually friends and colleagues that were shovel bums or something, and they finally got these, you know, these government jobs, and now they're in there, and they're really struggling under mountains and mountains of paperwork and organizational problems and all these other things. They may have a mandate to preserve these in a certain way, but I mean, how do we really go about addressing that problem with it being so huge and multifaceted? You know what I mean?
Well, I actually don't think it's so hard. I think the legacy data are a harder problem.
Sure.
But if we take, what if we said, you in every scope of work for a survey or excavation, you have a clause that says the digital data from this project will all be deposited in a responsible digital repository.
Mm-hmm.
That's a perfectly, just like you, I mean, it's basically just the same thing as saying the artifacts that you excavate need to be put in a reasonable physical repository. Just the same kind of requirement that you have there. I think the law not only authorizes that, it requires that they do that. The project cost doesn't go up. You may spend, you know, 1 or 2 or 3% of the project budget doing digital curation, which is far cheaper than physical artifact curation, of course. But I think that trade-off is well worth it. So I don't think it increases, you know, other than changing their boilerplate scope of work, I don't think it's any work at all for them. And what we found is that agencies that we've worked with on legacy data, they use TDAR in this case for an organizational tool. So all their offices have access to all of those reports. And we find often that the government agencies themselves don't have copies of the reports that they authorize. Once they get them up on TDAR, then they can use them. Some of the DOD installations, they have relatively few archaeological staff, although they do are responsible for a lot of archaeology. One archaeologist may be responsible for several bases, but all this stuff is on TDAR, so they can get at it wherever they are.
And does TDAR enforce any sort of data standards or types for data? Like, I mean, I can't imagine somebody would want to upload a bunch of Word documents of site records or something like that, because who knows how long a Word document is going to be readable for, right? So, but does TDAR allow that, or do they enforce a certain type?
We have a limited number of data formats that we'll accept. I mean, they actually include Word, they include PDF for documents, and just plain ASCII. Mm-hmm. For images, there's, again, a few. And what we do is as we migrate, so we always will keep the original copy of the database or Word document or whatever, mm-hmm. But we move it into a preservation format immediately if it's not in a preservation format. And then as those formats themselves change, then it's our responsibility to migrate each of those files to an updated version that's readable today. So that's the accessible version.
That's interesting.
So that's what a digital repository needs to do, or otherwise this stuff becomes unreadable. So, I mean, for that reason, we've restricted the number of different file types that we accept just for that reason, so we can have some chance of keeping those things alive. You know, and some of the more challenging things are things like, which we're not taking right now, are things like LIDAR and so forth, which are becoming more important, but the formats are to do those in preservation mode are very difficult, because a lot of them 3D things are, you know, device dependent and stuff like that.
What do you consider to be current good preservation formats?
Let's see. I'd have to look. I mean, I think we used migrate things from, you know, for the Microsoft, we have Access, we're using Word, PDF. It turns out PDF is a lot harder, worse as a preservation format than you'd think. So we use PDFA for the PDF documents. The Word ones we migrate forward. For databases, we'll also deconstruct them into CSV files, mm-hmm. so that we can get at them in the long run. That doesn't preserve everything, but it's better than nothing.
Right.
And then I think we're doing JPEGs, and I think... and TIFFs for sure. I actually don't know all the details on which image formats we're taking other than those two.
No, that's fine. I didn't actually mean to put you on the spot to ask too specifically what kinds of formats we need to have. It's just, this is a topic that we touch on quite frequently, where we say, you know, make sure that your file formats aren't totally proprietary. If they are, you can export them in some way that somebody down the road will be able to read them. We talk about refreshing our data file formats. It's nice to hear that that you've taken all that into account yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm curious. We talk about PDFs as generally being better than some other formats because they are readable by, you know, multiple devices and over long spans of time. What are the issues? You mentioned PDFs have some issues. Can you think of anything that you can mention to our listeners?
Well, you know, that's, you really should talk to one of our technical people.
Yeah. I
mean, partly that you can embed all this stuff in, you know, straight documents, I think, are not much of a problem. But, you know, you start putting images in, and then you've got these PDFs that are actually compilations of multiple PDFs, and there's a bunch of different flavors. And I've heard this both from our technical people and from the Archaeology Data Service people in England, that the PDFs actually can be challenging in the long run. I mean, in the short run, they're pretty easy, but in the long run, they're pretty challenging. I don't think we have anything better, but it's not as easy as I think most people, including me, until recently.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, we're pretty close to a break, so rather than going over, I'm going to call this break right here, and we will come back and continue talking about disappearing archaeological data and maybe what we can do to stop it from disappearing with Dr. Keith Kente. Back in a second.
This network is listener supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.archpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.archpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.archpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show.
All right, welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 92, and we are talking with Dr. Keith Kente, and he wrote an article that has been floating around the interwebs called America's Archaeology Data Keeps Disappearing, Even though the law says the government is supposed to preserve it. So what has the reception to this article been? You said in the last segment that it looks like over 19,000 people have at least clicked on the article and presumably read part of it. Have you received much feedback on this, positive or negative?
I mean, there's a few comments on the web. Some of them are a little far out. I've gotten quite a bit of feedback from people just in emails, you know, individual emails to me, you know, a lot of support, primarily supportive ones saying, yes, this, I'm glad you did that. We need to do that. So, I mean, I've gotten quite a bit of positive feedback on it.
Okay. Any negative feedback on it? I can't imagine from archaeologists.
Well, there was one on the, that's on the,
it's always one,
the conversation website who said, we don't have a problem in Arizona. It's all taken care of, which I think is not true. I think there's a bit of chip on the shoulder with that.
Right, right. I think every state and probably every agency has some level of complexity and problem in dealing with preserving data, if not just the sheer volume in dealing with that. Even if they have a way to take it in, the sheer volume is always a problem, you know, expansion, things like that. I've got a question. I work for, and we run the ads for this company on this podcast all the time, but I work for a company called WildNote, and we have created a platform for collecting digital, archaeological, and other environmental data, and then turning that into, you know, different exports and things like that. What would you tell somebody like me, working with a company like this and having the developers in my ear, what would you tell somebody who's developing something like that or collecting data digitally in the field about collecting data in the field? And let me clear that up just a little bit. What kind of best practices do you think people can have when they're collecting data digitally?
I think there's a lot of things. I mean, I think, you know, the way the world is, we need to think about archaeological workflows from, you know, the design of the project and the way the data are collected before any data are collected, you know, clear through the ongoing project, you know, to the time that it's really finished and put to bed. I think there's a publication that's online. There's also a print version of Guides to Best practices for digital archaeological data that we did jointly with the Archaeological Data Service in England. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think collecting the data, I think sort of at the highest level, collecting the data with the notion that somebody else might want to look at it, and including with the data the information that somebody needs to properly interpret it. It sounds obvious, but I think people, you know, get in a rut or in a groove where, you know, they know what they're doing, they know what report they're going to write, they have somebody who works on the analyses, and it's done. But I think a lot of times that's not done with the goals beyond getting the project properly done, and that may be done quite well. But I think being able to have data that lives on requires some additional thought. In particular, you know, what I'm sure you guys have talked about with metadata. I mean, mm-hmm. and to me, the sort of biggest question is what information, and I think the problem is biggest with databases. You know, you'd hope that documents are relatively self-explanatory, but with databases in particular, what would a reasonably competent archaeologist need to know to use this data in a responsible way? For example, in many cases, databases include the data that were collected, but they don't, in the database themselves, say anything about the sampling strategies. You know, was stuff screened? Was it not screened? Was every third bucket not screened? You know, what? How was the data collected in a way that would affect your interpretations? If you're looking at stuff that's screened versus not screened or partially screened, how does that affect things? Well, that often doesn't get recorded in the database or associated with the database, and somebody who was unaware of that would probably misinterpret the results of an analysis. So I think, you know, keeping in mind how it would be used in the future is tricky, but it's something we need to spend more time and energy on.
Yeah, that goes along with something that's always been a pet peeve of mine is site records. And when you write down different interpretations on site records, say, you know, a lot of people use like a five-stage biface system when they're talking about bifaces, or they'll say tertiary, secondary, and primary in relation to flake size or flake cortex amount, but therein lies the problem. How do you know what methodology was used to come up with these terms unless you put it on the site record? And the argument is, well, it's in the report, in the methods section. I was like, well, you can't assume that the report and the site record are always going to be in the same location. You know, and just like your database, you can't assume the report where they probably say what methods are used to construct the database. The report's not there anymore. It's just a database.
Right. And what we try to do in TDAR is prompt people. I mean, there are things I know, like sampling strategies that aren't explicitly asked for, but we try to, at a table by table and column by column of the data set, ask mm-hmm. people to document things or provide references to what they're doing. We don't require that everybody do everything all the time, but we try to give people the opportunity to put pretty complete metadata with their databases. I mean, same thing with images. If you don't say what the image is, it doesn't, you know, if you don't have something to do with it, most of them are not very helpful.
Indeed.
All right. So Keith, you've written this article. It's obviously, it's not a one-off. You've been working around issues of data collection and data preservation for quite a long time. You've gotten some reception. Unfortunately, I saw some of the comment thread, and I don't think we have to worry about archaeologists hiding data because we don't want to show the giants. But I'm hoping that you got some serious feedback on it and hoping that you continue to get some. What would be the best kind of outcome, do you see, from a public face to this problem of disappearing archaeological data?
Well, I think the best outcome is what I mentioned earlier, which would be for the agencies. This could happen at different levels, at a district office or a state office or nationally, to take those responsibilities seriously and start to implement requirements for digital curation for the data that they're responsible for or authorize the collection of. I think that's a pretty easy step. I think once people start doing that and we start at least moving the newly created data into that stream, I think people will see even more utility than they anticipated from that, mm-hmm. Partly for their own record keeping, and because it really does make it available, and other people will find it when they're doing context studies or just doing background studies for the next project going on. And then I think, you know, we're still faced with the problem of we've got, you know, 100 years and especially the last 50 years of data that have been collected, and there's a lot of digital data in there. getting that is a more difficult problem that we didn't address earlier, just because that costs real money that's not there. For the ongoing projects, there's money there. You know, there's a question about how you allocate it, but there's money to do them. Mm-hmm. But for the legacy data, I think that is a responsibility. I think that's going to be a harder challenge because people are going to have to decide that it's worth it. And I think it's partly incumbent on archaeologists and especially people who are concerned about the bigger picture to say, well, can we really learn from it? I think, you know, some of these synthesis efforts, we have to, you know, put our money where our mouth is and really show that this benefits people. And it can benefit people in terms of public policy, maybe at the top level, but also just in terms of bureaucratic efficiency at lower levels. I think it can save agencies money just by simplifying some of their own processes and so forth. But I think that's going to be a much harder problem to solve. If we can start with the new data, with scope of work or similar kinds of requirements, I think that's pretty easy, and that's where I'm hoping this will go.
Okay, well, I like that you're breaking it down between, you know, legacy data, which is its own can of worms, and new data. One thing I'd worry about going forward is finger pointing. Archaeologists pointing to the preservation offices saying, how come you're not doing this? Preservation offices pointing back to the archaeologists saying, how come you're not making this easier for us to do properly? Which side of this, who do you think bears the onus of responsibility to make sure that this happens properly amongst us professionals?
I think the onus is primarily on the agencies, the agencies that are authorizing or permitting or paying for the work. I think the CRM firms are in a bind because they, on the one hand, want to be responsible, and they may all think that this would be a good thing to do. But if they do it, it's costing them money and they're not going to be competitive with their competitors who mm-hmm. are not doing it and saving that money. So I think to the extent that, I mean, I understand firms having to remain competitive or they're out of business. I think with agencies, they can take on that responsibility for the ongoing projects pretty easily. But I do think the onus, the burden really is there at the moment. You know, there's lots of things that would be good to do. Some of them are harder than others. This one seems to me to be a fairly easy one for the new projects. And that's, at least we won't be getting farther behind, which we're doing every day right now.
Hmm. Do you think to get the agencies to really take this on as a thing and really enforce these standards, do you think the money is already there? It's just not being used properly, or that it would take a, you know, so to speak, act of Congress and some kind of vote to allocate more funds towards doing this?
Oh, no, I don't think it takes any act of Congress or even I don't think it's bureaucratically difficult. I think it really mm-hmm. is just individual offices or preferably at higher levels, them saying, oh, well, we should just put this in our scope of work. Similarly, I mean, it's some of the same regulations that require the federal curation regulations. They also apply to digital data explicitly. So, you know, there's authorization for them to do this. And I think, you know, they've got a budget for a contract project that they're doing today. And I think it's worth, just like I think it's worth money to curate the physical artifacts, I think it's worth some much smaller fraction of the money to curate the digital artifacts of the data of the project.
Yeah, that's really interesting talking about enforcement, because I had a conversation with an agency archaeologist at a high level position here in Nevada a few years ago, and they're no longer in that position. Somebody else is in that job now, but I had a conversation with them about this, and I was curious because, you know, most of Nevada is BLM land. So if you're going to do archaeology in Nevada, you need a BLM permit. And I said, how often do you guys pull BLM permits from a company or suspend it or something like that for infractions, archaeologically related infractions, whether it's something in the field, something that was done improperly or improperly turned in deliverables and, you know, data formats and things like that. And they said almost never. Like in the history, this person had been there like 20 years. There's like one permit was pulled from an archaeological firm. And yet they all admit that when site records are turned in, reports are turned in, often the reports are not in the format listed in the guidelines. Site records aren't missing information. The GIS data is not complete. It's missing information or it's in incorrect formats. And they usually just deal with it. That's what they said. They usually just deal with it. And they don't, there's no going back to the firm and saying, nope, we're not going to accept this. You know, how do we, you have any idea how we can maybe combat that problem? Do you hear of stuff like that happening down where you're at?
You know, I'm not too much involved at that level. What you said doesn't surprise me. I was long ago was at the Arizona State Museum, part of the University of Arizona, and was dealing, I was really the main person who issued permits and so forth. I think that sort of thing is always going to be a problem. You know, we have a similar problem with National Science Foundation grants. Now people have to, and NEH grants too, you have to put a data management plan in there, but those are not very effectively enforced, I think, except that if reviewers go back and look and say, well, you know, I reviewed this person's last proposal and they said they were going to make this data available and they haven't, then maybe not getting funded in the future. I think the agencies could do some of that, perhaps more easily than they can, you know, deny permits. But if you say, well, you know, do you meet the minimum qualifications? I think it will be a problem, but I think there could be some ways to address that. And if those, you know, if we get 80% compliance, that's a whole lot better than, you know, 0% compliance.
What do you think the public can do about this problem? Is there anybody they can contact or call? I mean, this article was not written for archaeologists in a private forum that only archaeologists can see. So what would you expect the public to get out of this as a message to take home?
You know, I would certainly be happy if people would write their senators and congressmen saying, what are we doing about this? And those people, especially people on like the energy and resources committees, can start calling up the people in the interior agencies or in DOD or whatever, saying, well, why aren't we doing this? You know, this is our public money. We care about the past. You know, I think if we can generate some pressure on the agencies, either by way of Congress or directly, if people talk to the agency people directly, you know, I don't think there's any sort of ill will here. I don't think it's a conspiracy, unlike a couple of those comments suggested. But, it's just another bureaucratic step and people are too busy. But I think it's just something that's important enough that we need to get on it.
Yeah. Well, it's a lack of resources in some cases, but I think you hit the nail on the head with CRM firms. It's a lack of, anytime they have to spend extra money, even a few dollars here and there, reduces their competitive advantage on an already tight margin industry. And that therein lies the problem. So
you want to level the playing field with the CRM firms, and the agencies can do that, which they can't, which the firms can't do individually.
For sure. They're just going to compete for the lowest bids. Okay. Well, we're just about out of time, Keith. Is there anything you want to say about this article or this topic that we haven't asked you about?
I don't think there's anything individual. I'll send you a copy of the legal analysis that really shows where the legal requirements are, and you can put a link to that on your website if you like.
That'd
absolutely.
People, I mean, I'd hope that agency people might be interested in looking at that. This was done by a legal firm in Washington to sort of say, what are the federal requirements for the curation of digital archaeological data?
Okay. Well, we will certainly include that in our show notes and of course, the original link to this article. And again, thank you, Keith, for coming on the show and talking about this.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you for giving me the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. Now back to the show.
Okay, welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 92, and this is the App of the Day segment. So I was going through our list of apps, Paul, that we had talked about, and I had a few things on the list that I've been meaning to talk about, and I can't believe I haven't mentioned this app, and it's something I use subconsciously sort of all the time, and it's called Blotter, Blotter, and we'll have a link to at least the iTunes Apple version in the store here. I'm not actually sure that it works on other computers, but it definitely works with Apple computers. And what Blotter is it's basically ties to your calendars on your computer, and it puts an overlay on your desktop background, whatever desktop background you have, of this transparent calendar. And you can invoke the calendar and make it not transparent just by clicking on the menu bar icon. But you can also do different things, like you can have your reminders over there. And if you keep like a to-do list on your reminders, then all you got to do is like on an Apple machine, you can four finger expand on your trackpad on the modern machines and make all your windows go away for a minute and then quickly see your calendar rather than trying to find the calendar app or turn it on or something like that. You can just see this thing. And so every time I'm opening a new screen or doing something like that, I see my calendar sitting right there. And I use my calendar extensively. Like if it's not on my calendar, it's simply not going to happen. And I would miss appointments all the time if they weren't on my calendar and sending me alerts. So the fact that I'm constantly referring back to it, and maybe when I have I've got two screens on my office system, and then, you know, you have different workspaces that you can scroll between. So when you add two screens times the number of workspaces I've usually got, I'm scrolling back and forth with, that's like 8 to 12 screens that something could be on. Right. And all I have to do to see my calendar, rather than just kind of find it, is just look at my desktop and there it is. And it's pretty handy. I really like it. There's a lot of customizability you can do to it. I have it take up the entire desktop screen. You can have it take up a custom size of screen or small portion of your screen or something like that if you really want to see your background, because it will obscure your background a little bit, your desktop background, whatever you have. But I don't think it's obtrusive, and I love seeing it. And it's a fantastic little application that just runs in the background, starts up with my computer. Like I said, I got so used to having it, I didn't even realize it was another application until I saw it in the list here. It's just something that exists like my operating system does, and I really enjoy it. So I would say check that out. I think it's free. If it's not free, it's not that much money, because I wouldn't have paid a ton of money for this thing. So yeah, definitely check that out. We'll have that link in the show notes. What do you think about that, Paul? Sound like something useful?
It wouldn't be for me personally. Just I don't have, I've mentioned before, I use Spaces my computer, right? So if I want a calendar, I've got it over on the next space, and I just mm-hmm. swipe over to it. In the early days of OS X, there was a system preference. I can't remember the name of it now. They would do something similar. It wasn't specific to calendars, but you could run different scripts, like Unix scripts, and it would put the output in a semi-transparent or translucent box on your desktop behind everything. Now I use that quite a bit, and I probably use that with a calendar, just a static calendar, so you could see the days of the month. But nothing like this. It would actually pull from your calendars. Is this tied into your iCal calendar on your Mac, or can it pull in from various online calendars like Google Calendar?
You know, I think it can pull in from other calendars, but it works best with the native calendar app on my Mac. You know, that's what it's designed to really work well with. But to your point about, you know, your calendar is always up because you use Spaces. I use Spaces too, because you told me about it. Or Spectacles. I use Spectacle.
I love that one.
Yeah. I use that because you recommended it, and I use it extensively now. And then let's talk about all the apps we use here right now. So I use Spectacle, but then I also use just like Apple Automator to create the app that I mentioned a few episodes back. I called the app Start My Day, and that loads up all the programs that I want to start my day with, including my calendar. And then unfortunately, it just loads them sort of randomly on the screen, and then I have to organize them. And I always have the calendar, you know, in the lower right hand corner of my left screen. So I do know where it's at all times. But where Blotter comes in handy for me is I'm constantly, you know, closing some windows, opening new programs, going to a new space, doing some things. And maybe the calendar screen is just not in focus right now. Maybe it's not even up right now because it's in a different hidden space, right? And I've got to go back to that sort of home space to see the calendar. But I use my calendar so much, and I need to see it so often that, you know, maybe I haven't looked at it in an hour. Maybe I haven't been over on that end of the computer in a while. But I'm on a blank screen and I just need to open a Finder window and do something. Well, I can quickly see my calendar right there. And it's saved my ass a few times where maybe an appointment got put on that I didn't have a reminder for. And an appointment on my calendar without a reminder set up that buzzes my watch or my phone is just as good as not being there at all. So, you know, but Blotter has saved my ass sometimes when that's happened, because I'll then just I'll catch it out of the corner of my eye. You know, it has a line like your calendar normally does that shows you what time of day it is. Mm-hmm. So you know where you're looking, and you can, one of the things I like about Blotter is you can organize it to have, it shows you 7 days at a time, but you can say, I want to see a week that starts on Monday or starts on Saturday or starts on Sunday, whatever you want. Or you can just have the first day on the left is the current day. So it shows you today plus the next 6 days at all times. So, and I have it on that view because when I am just glancing at it, because it is kind of in the background, I know today is always on the left. It's always the left column. I don't have to look at it and spend any more brain power, you know, even though it's just a few seconds. I don't have to spend any more time. I just quickly glance over there when I get rid of all my windows. Yep. Okay. I'm on track for today. Everything's good. There's no surprises. And I keep moving on. And that's why I like it. It's just one of those really subtle applications that really gives me a lot of benefit. And sometimes I like I said, I forget it's even there. But it's still a benefit to me. So, okay. Well, I think we've killed that calendar app to death. So, Paul, what have you got for us today?
Okay. So what I've got is, the fact that I didn't have anything new to talk about. So I'm just talking about something that we've all known about for a while. And I had just used it recently. So I wanted to remind people that this exists if they don't already know about it. So what I'm talking about is the Keynote app on iOS. And I don't actually use the Keynote app for developing Keynote presentations or anything like that. I use Keynote on my Mac, and I like it best between Google Slides and PowerPoint and Keynote. I prefer Keynote and have used it for years. I give a number of different talks, basically two different kinds of lectures. There'll be the lecture I do when I'm teaching a course, and I'll have my Keynote up, and I'll use a clicker, and I'll have a stack of papers because I've got a million different points I need to make, and I've got facts and figures I want to give to the students. Afterwards, I bundle that up as a PDF and put it up on the Moodle so that they can see it, because otherwise it's just too much information at once for anybody to keep track of writing things down. But that's one way I do it. The other way is what I've done over the last couple of weeks, where I give more informal talks. You know, so if I give a lecture to the general public and I'm not trying to just give them a fire hose of different facts and figures, I try to make a more lively presentation, and I want to be able to roam around a lot, and I want to be able to make a lot of eye contact, and I want people to raise their hands, and I take questions and move along like that, get interrupted. It's a much more fun way for me to work. And so I use the Keynote presentation on my Mac connected to a projector. And then I use the remote function of Keynote on the iOS device on my phone in order to scroll through the slides. The particular view that I use there, I've got a few bullet points at the bottom, my presenter's notes of maybe a term I want to specifically use, or just a couple things so I remember what order I wanted to mention a couple points that pertain to the slide given. And so I use it mostly as a clicker in these cases, in this kind of a lecture. And I look down every now and then. I'll glance at it quickly if I need to just remind myself where I am, where I'm at, what place in this lecture I'm at. You know, so it's very different style of lecturing than when I have a class that I'm teaching. And I find that for that kind of lecture, it really, really is a helpful tool. I'm going to give a little tip for this, is that sometimes it doesn't connect up to Keynote on the Mac very reliably. So in those cases, what I do is I just have my Mac create its own Wi-Fi network, and I then attach to that Wi-Fi network on my phone, and then they have no trouble at all seeing each other. So the lectures I've been giving over the last couple of weeks is at the school I work. There's a big Mesopotamia curriculum in the fifth grade, and every year I get invited up into the fifth grade classrooms to go talk about archaeology in Mesopotamia. I've worked in Mesopotamian sites, never in Iraq, unfortunately, but in Syria and Turkey. And so I talk to the students about how the sites are formed, about what archaeologists in Mesopotamia do, how they go about their work, what they're looking for. I bring in some tools. I bring my mud brick pick. I threaten to kill a kid. It's a lot of fun. It's a kind of silly, but I think I give them a lot of good information. But I couldn't give that kind of a talk with a lot of back and forth and a lot of interaction with the audience if I didn't have a tool like this, like the remote that I have on the Keynote on iOS.
Yeah.
There we go. Do you use anything like that?
I do. And I've used Keynote for that in that exact same way on iOS, because I really like it works well if you're just using it to tap through your slides. You know, if you're just holding your phone and tapping through your slides, although if you tap in the wrong spot, you can do some other things. And if I'm not mistaken, it's been a little while. It actually has a little laser pointer feature on there as well. Yeah. And but then also, if I'm also not mistaken, if you go into landscape view, you can actually see like a presenter view a little bit where you're you've got the next up slide and things like that. I think if you're doing that, though, you may as well just have a computer in front of you, because if you're trying to walk around and then glance, you know, stare at your phone trying to figure out what you're doing, it's not going to work. But I've used the remote function before on my watch as well, as we were talking about before the recording. And that's a little hard to get used to. Obviously, way less functional than the phone. Really just intended for advancing through slides. But again, if you don't know what you're hitting and what you're doing in a nice fluid motion, you can really screw up your presentation. And of course, in presentations, you don't want to take away from the presentation itself with technical difficulties. We've all seen that many times. So yeah, it's a good add-on to some of those practices. And if you want to use that, you have iOS devices, but let's say you don't know how to use Keynote or don't want to, Keynote will import PowerPoint. And I don't know about Google Slides. It probably doesn't work with Google Slides, but
you can export a PowerPoint from Google Slides and then import that into Keynote.
Yeah. There you go. There you go. It's a good workflow. I'm sure none of your fonts or formatting would get screwed up doing that.
Oh, no. It must be just flawless. I can't imagine anything possibly going wrong with that.
That's right. That's right. All right. So I think that's about anything else on Keynote and stuff like that, Paul?
No, again, it's just, depending on the kind of presentation you're giving, if you have something with a lot of text that you have to read through, it's not the right tool for the job. Right. If you're just going through the slides and you have everything memorized, maybe you can use a regular pointer, clicker and pointer. Mm-hmm. But if you're trying to do something like what I'm doing, where there's a lot of interaction and there are a lot of ways that the lecture can go sideways, but you want to have that little crib sheet right there so that you can quickly glance down, see what the slide is, and see the points that you needed to make about that slide, then it works really nicely.
Yeah. Okay, so let's close out the last few minutes of this segment and talk about the current giveaway that we're doing. We mentioned on the last episode that Paul has generously donated his time and money to really write click buy now and change the address and send you a drone straight from Amazon. And he's got this one. So it's the Metacu M1 mini drone. There's a link to it in the show notes. It's in episode 91, and I'll drop it in episode 92 as well. So go over and check that out. And the only thing we're asking for between now and the next episode, so episode 93 is when we were hoping to announce a winner for this, is engage with us on social media or through email. And basically, you know, Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, we're at ArcPodNet on each one of those resources. First off, follow us, of course, and then send us a message or put up a picture that says, I want a drone, or why you want a drone, what are you going to use one for? You know, something just simple, something really simple. But be sure to include ArcPodNet, tag us in that post if you're doing it from your own, and then also maybe put hashtag Archaeotech in there. And you can also send me an email, chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com, and ask a question about a show or something else, or just say, hey, enter me in the contest. We're not picky.
And just so the listeners know, this is not a drone that you're going to use to take beautiful aerials of your excavation unit. This is a little 3.5-inch across toy drone. But what it's going to do is it's going to give you a good sense of how the controls work, because I found that this one is just a blast to fly, and it's really, really easy. So if you want to just get your feet wet for no cost beyond just, you know, engaging with us for a little bit on social media, this is as good an intro as any, I think.
Yeah. And as we said last time, this is open to U.S. residents only, just because it would cost 3 times the amount of this drone is worth to send this somewhere else in the country or in the world. So yeah, maybe we can come up with something for the rest of the world later. But for right now, U.S. residents only. And also, you know, this drone, I'm looking at the description right now, it says it has headless mode. And Paul, you asked me about that 1 or 2 episodes ago, and I really knew shockingly little about what headless mode is. But I did some research on it, and I now know why I didn't know what headless mode really was. The reason is because as things get commercialized, of course, like, you know, drones is just the new name for these things. Really, we're talking about RC aircraft, and you know, RC planes and even RC helicopters have been around for a really long time. But they were really, because of the complexity of flying them, they were only open to a small percentage of the population that really wanted to put the time and money into not only building it in a lot of cases, but then flying it, repairing it. You know, you're just an all-in-one mechanic shop. But as these things got cheaper and really, we don't need to worry about repairing it. Like, you're going to break this $17 drone at some point, but you're not going to care. You're not going to go buy parts for it. You're just going to buy a new one, right? So as that's come down, they've had to, as they do, make it easier, or so they think, easier for people to fly. So one big problem with all radio-controlled aircraft is that you are fixed and stationary, and the thing that you're flying is moving. And when that thing is moving and you're using one of your sticks to go left and right, when that thing's coming towards you and you go left, the aircraft goes right. And when you go right, the aircraft goes left, because its orientation is always on the nose of the aircraft of what its left and right is. It doesn't matter what direction it's pointing in relation to you. Its left and right is in relation to its own nose. Well, when you put these things in headless mode, and this is really mostly open to what they call the toy class of drones, not the hobby grade, is if it's flying towards you, once you put it into headless mode, if it's flying towards you and you go left, it's going to go left, even though its nose is pointing towards you, or it's going to go right, you know, because it knows what orientation it is. And from what my understanding is, you usually put these things in a stable hover with the nose facing away from you directly, like perpendicular to your body, and you're looking down the axis of it, and then you engage headless mode. Now it has its orientation set and it knows what direction it's pointing regardless. So if it spins all the way around, it doesn't really know it's pointing at you, but it knows it's pointing the other way, and that left is now right and right is now left, you know, things like that. It's very complicated. And my advice is, and the advice of some of the articles I read was basically, if you want to get up into the bigger, higher end drones, learn how to cross control. And that's what that's called. Learn how, when the drone's coming towards you, if you go left, it's going to go right. Just learn that. It's just muscle memory and you'll be fine, because most of the higher end drones and even the mid-grade drones do not come with headless mode and probably never will. So, and if you ever want to fly those first person point of view or FPV drones with the goggles and the competition racing ones, those will definitely not have headless mode, although it kind of is, because you're right in the drone. So anyway, that's headless mode in a nutshell. And I would say play with it, but don't learn on it.
No, I would say don't even bother playing with it. Every time I've accidentally put this thing in headless mode, I don't know which way it's going. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you have to calibrate it into headless mode the right way too. Like, if it's pointing the wrong direction when you put it in headless mode, oh, it's going to be
chaos. And that's
chaos.
Precisely the problem. Every time I've done it, I've done it by accident while it's going, you know, while it's halfway across the room and it's going diagonal to me. And now left isn't left. It's, 45 degrees to the right.
Right. Yeah, I can see that causing huge problems. I've never flown a drone in headless mode. I looked at the small, cheap ones I've got at my Civil Air Patrol office, and those don't even have headless mode. So I think that was something that came along in the last year or two, maybe. And it's really started to become an option on the cheaper toy drones. So people have a real hard time with cross controlling and wrapping their head around it. But once you get it, you get it. Yeah. You know? So,
well, the important points: small, cheap drone, very easy to learn on. You're going to want it because you're going to want to learn how to fly drones, and you're going to want to tell us on social media why you want to learn how to fly drones. And this is a great little, intro for you before you move up to something bigger that you're going to be able to use, actually for archaeological data collection.
Absolutely. Well said. Okay, so that's it for this show. Again, we really appreciate Dr. Keith Kintyre coming along and talking about that article. I really love getting to the bottom of some of these things from the people who are directly responsible for them. So if you happen to read any articles out there and think we should check it out and maybe we can get a hold of the author, then really let us know and we'll do it. Paul, hope you stay warm. It's starting to get cold out here in Reno. I'm sure it is in New York.
Yeah, it's all rainy right now. We're recording this on the evening of election night. So
that's right.
I'd say get out and vote, but it's going to be a week and a half at the earliest before anybody hears this and you miss the vote. So
yeah, if you're listening to this, it's time to come out of your bunker. You know, hopefully we all survived.
Maybe it's not.
And maybe it's not. Yeah, who knows? Who knows? Yeah, you might come out into a apocalypse and be in headless mode yourself. So, oh, that's a bad joke.
No.
Anyway, all right. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, send in anything you can on social media about this drone thing, and we'll send you a drone in a couple weeks. One drone only, please. I'm not going to send everybody a drone. And again, thank you, Paul, for joining me and for donating the drone.
Thanks, Chris. Talk to you again. Thanks for listening to the ArchaeoTech Podcast. Links to items mentioned on the show are in the show notes at www.archpodnet.com/ArchaeoTech. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and paul@lugal.com. Support the show by becoming a member at archpodnet.com/members. The music is a song called Off Road and is license free from Apple. Thanks for listening.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.